That it is. Velen's shameful hope faded as Governor Arawan's portly form emerged from the mansion. He hates us, but he loves his daughter. It's how I got him to surrender the city.
You threatened her?
Sharon gaped at him. Faith, this war has made you a monster. I wouldn't have hurt her. Don't say any more, Velen. She shook her head, eyes closed in disgust, turning away from him. Just stop talking, please. They stood in icy silence as the governor approached, the guard scrupulously looking elsewhere, and Velen feeling Sharon's anger like a knife. When the governor arrived, Velen made the introductions and worked the key in the heavy padlock securing the gate.
She grows weaker, Arawan said, hauling the gate open, his voice frantic with hope and desperation.
She was still talking last night, but this morning...
Then we'd best not linger, my lord. If you could help me with this.
Velen set the chest down, and Sister Sharon and the governor hefted it together and started back towards the mansion. She offered no word of farewell.
How long will this take, sister? He asked.
She halted, glancing back, her face devoid of emotion. The curative requires several hours' preparation. Once administered, the improvements should be immediate.
Come back in the morning.
She turned away again.
Why were you shackled?
He demanded before she could leave.
Why were you under guard?
She didn't turn back, her answer so soft he almost missed it.
Because I tried to save you.
He sent the guards away and settled down to wait, lighting a fire and huddling in his cloak. The onset of winter added a chill to the wind sweeping in from the sea. The hours stretched as he pondered Sharon's words and brooded on her anger.
I tried to save you.
As the sun faded towards the horizon, Frentis appeared, sitting opposite and adding some wood to the fire. Velen glanced up at him but said nothing.
Brother Commander Iltis will live, Frentis said,
his tone deliberately light.
More's the pity. Can't talk yet, though, just grunts and moans on account of his jaw.
No great loss. Heard enough of his guff during the voyage.
You said the Aspect ordered you to allow her to be treated like that,
Velen said.
Why?
Frentis's expression was pained, reluctant to share what he knew would be unwelcome information.
Sister Sharon is a convicted traitor to the realm, and a denier of the faith.
Sharon in the Black Hold. The thought of it sent waves of guilt and worry coursing through him.
What had she suffered there?
I went straight to Aspect Alera when we docked, Frentis continued.
Like you told me.
When she heard what I had to say, we went to Aspect Arlin. He was able to talk the king into releasing the sister from the palace.
The palace?
She wasn't in the Black Hold.
Seems she was kept there when the Fourth Order first arrested her, but Princess Lerna got her out.
Apparently she just marched in and demanded they release the sister into her custody. The warden thought she was acting on the king's order, so handed her over. Rumor is Aspect Altendris was hopping mad when he heard, but there wasn't much he could do about it. Sister Sharon was still a prisoner anyway, just had a nicer prison. What could she have done that could ever be considered treason, let alone denial of the faith?
She spoke against the war. Not just once, either. Many times. To anyone who'd listen.
Said the war was founded on lies and contrary to the faith.
Said you and all the rest of us had been sent to our doom for no good reason.
Wouldn't have mattered so much if it had been some nobody spouting off. But she's well known in the poorer parts of the capital. Well liked, too, on account of all the people she's helped.
When she spoke, people listened.
Seems neither the king nor the Fourth Order liked what she had to say.
More of the old man's scheming?
Velen wondered.
Perhaps he knew about his attachment to Sharon, and her arrest was another means of applying pressure.
He felt it unlikely. Janice had already secured his obedience. Sharon's arrest seemed an act born of simple fear. His war could not be undone by a dissenting voice.
Velen knew well the king's ruthlessness, but to publicly arrest a well-liked sister of the Fifth Order was hardly the subtle, insidious move he favored.
He must have tried something else, Velen concluded, some other way to silence her or buy her loyalty.
So she had the strength to resist him where I did not. The king only agreed to Sharon's release on condition she'd be shackled and kept under constant guard, Prentice went on.
She's also forbidden to talk to anyone without permission.
Prentice tugged an envelope from his cloak and held it out to Valin.
The details are here. Aspect Darlin said we should observe them.
Valin took the envelope and tossed it on the fire, watching the wax of the king's seal bubble and run in the flames.
It seems the king has reprieved Sister Sharon and ordered her immediate release, he told Prentice in a tone that didn't invite argument, in recognition of her long years of service to the realm and the faith.
Prentice's eyes flicked to the now charred envelope, but didn't linger.
Of course, brother.
He shifted nervously, clearly debating whether to voice something more.
What is it, brother? Valin prompted tiredly. There was a girl, came to the dockside when we were getting ready to leave. Asked if I could give you this.
His hand emerged from his cloak again, clutching a small package wrapped in plain paper.
Pretty thing she was. Almost made me sorry I joined the order.
Valin took the package, opening it to find two thin wooden blocks tied together with a blue silk ribbon. Inside was a single winter bloom, pressed flat on a white card.
Did she say anything?
Only that I should convey her thanks.
Didn't say what for.
Valin was surprised to find a smile on his lips.
Thank you, brother.
He retied the ribbon and consigned the blocks to his pocket.
Didn't happen to bring some food, did you? I'm quite starved.
Prentice made a journey back down the hill and returned half an hour later with Canis, Barkers, and Dentos, each laden with provisions and bedrolls.
Haven't slept under the stars for weeks now, Canis commented.
I find I miss it.
Oh, quite, Barkers drawled, unfolding his bedroll. My backside has indeed missed the joys of hard earth and sudden rain. Don't you lot have duties? Valin inquired.
We've decided to shirk them, my lord,
Dentos replied.
Going to flog us?
Depends on what kind of meal you've brought me.
They roasted a haunch of goat over the fire and shared bread and dates. Dentos opened a bottle of Cumbrelian Red and passed it round.
This is the last one, he said, his voice laden with regret.
Had Sergeant Gallus pack 20 bottles before we left.
Men do seem to drink more in time of war, observed Canis.
Can't imagine why, Barkers grunted.
For a while it was almost as it had been all those years ago, when Master Huttrell would lead them into the woods and they would camp out, boys sharing stories and mockery around the fire, except there were fewer of them now, and the humour had a bitter edge. Even Prentice, in his way the most guileless soul among them, was becoming prone to cynicism, regaling them with the news that the dungeons were once again empty as the king attempted to add ever more regiments to the realm guard.
More cutthroats ready to get their throats cut.
Seems fitting, Canis said. Those who have besmirched the king's peace should be obliged to make recompense. What better way than through service in war? And I have to say, former outlaws do make excellent soldiers.
No illusions, Barkers agreed.
No expectations. When you live your whole life in hardship, a soldier's life doesn't seem so bad.
Ask those poor bastards we left behind at the Bloody Hill how much they liked a soldier's life, Dentos said.
Barkers shrugged.
Soldier's life often means a soldier's death.
At least they get paid.
What do we get?
We get to serve the faith, Prentice put in.
It's enough for me.
Ah, but you're still young, in mind and body. Give it another year or two, and you'll be reaching for brother's friend to silence those pesky questions, like the rest of us.
Barkers tipped the wine bottle into his mouth, grimacing in disappointment as the last drops dribbled out.
Faith! I wish I were drunk, he grumbled, hurling the bottle into the darkness.
Don't you believe it, then? Prentice went on.
What we're fighting for?
We're fighting so the king can double his tax income.
Oh, innocent urchin.
Barkers pulled a flask of brother's friend from his cloak and took a long pull.
That's better.
That can't be right, Prentice protested. I mean, I know all that stuff about Alperin stealing children with so much horse dung, but we're bringing the faith here, right? These people need us. That's why the Aspect sent us.
His gaze swiveled to Valin.
Right?
Of course that's right,
Canis told him with his accustomed certainty. Our brother sees the basest motives in the purest actions.
Pure?
Barkers gave a long and hearty laugh.
What's pure about any of this? How many corpses are lying out there in the desert because of us? How many widows and orphans and cripples have we made? And what about this place? You think the Red Hand appearing here after we seized the city is just some huge coincidence? If we brought it with us, then it would have laid us low as well, Kanis snapped back. You speak such nonsense sometimes, brother.
Velen glanced back at the mansion as they continued to bicker. A dim light was burning in one of the upstairs windows, vague shadows moving behind the blinds.
Sharon at work, most probably.
He felt a sudden lurch of concern, feeling her vulnerability. If her curative failed to work, she was naked before the Red Hand, like Sister Gilmer. He would have sent her to her death, and she was so angry. He rose and went to the gate, eyes locked on the yellow square of the window, helplessness and guilt surging in his breast. He found he was already turning the key in the lock. If it works, then there is no danger. If it doesn't, then I can't linger here whilst she dies.
Brother?
Kenneth, voice heavy with warning. I have to— The blood song surged, a scream in his mind sending him to his knees. He clutched at the gate to keep from falling, feeling Barkus's strong hands bear him up.
Valin, is it the falling sickness again?
Despite the pain throbbing in his head, Valin found he could stand unaided, and there was no tang of blood in his mouth. He wiped at his nose and eyes, finding them dry. Not the same, but it was Arm Lin's song. A sudden, sick realization struck him, and he tore away from Barkus's grasp, eyes scanning the dark mass of the city, finding it quickly, a bright beacon of flame shining in the artisan's quarter. Arm Lin's shop was burning. The flames were reaching high into the sky when they arrived. The roof of the shop was gone, the blackened beams wreathed in fire. The heat was so intense they couldn't go within 10 yards of the door. A line of townsfolk relayed buckets from the nearest well, although the water they cast at the inferno had little effect. Velen moved among the crowd, searching frantically.
"Where's the mason?" he demanded. "Is he inside?"
People shrank from him, fear and animosity on every face. He told Kanis to ask them for the mason, and a few hands pointed to a cluster of people nearby. Arm Lin lay on the street, his head cradled in his wife's lap as she wept. Livid burns glistened on his face and arms. Velen knelt next to him, gently touching a hand to his chest to check he still drew breath.
"Get away!"
his wife lashed out, catching him on the jaw, pushing his hand away.
"Leave him alone!"
Her face was blackened with soot and livid with grief and fury.
"Your fault! Your fault, Hope Killer!"
Arm Lin coughed, lurched on the ground as he fought for breath, eyes blinking open.
"Nura La,"
his wife sobbed, pulling him close.
"Erha ne almash. Thank the nameless, not the gods."
Arm Lin rasped. His eyes found Valin, and he beckoned him closer, whispering in his ear.
"My wolf, brother."
His eyes flickered, and he lost consciousness. Velen sighing in relief at the sight of his swelling chest.
"Get him to the guild house," he ordered Dentos. "Find a healer."
Kenneth came to him as they carried Arm Lin away, his wife clutching his hand. "They found the man who did this," he said, gesturing at another knot of people. Velen rushed over, pushing through the cordon, and finding a battered corpse lying on the cobbles. He kicked the body onto its back, seeing a bruised and completely unfamiliar face. An Alperin face.
"Who is he?"
Velen asked, his gaze tracking the crowd as Kanis translated. After a moment a swarthy man stepped forward and spoke a few words, glancing uneasily at Velen.
"The mason is well thought of,"
Kanis related. "The work he does is considered sacred. This man shouldn't have expected mercy."
"I asked who he is," Velen grated.
Kanis relayed the question to the man, in his halting but precise Alperin, receiving only a blank shake of the head. Questions to the rest of the crowd elicited only meager information. No one seems to know his name, but he was a servant in one of the big houses. He took a blow to the head when they tried to break out a few weeks ago.
hasn't been the same since. Do they know why he did this?
This produced a babble of seemingly unanimous responses.
He was found standing in the street with a flaming torch in his hand, Canis said, shouting that the Mason was a traitor.
It seems the Mason's friendship with you caused some bad talk, but no one expected this.
Velen's scrutiny of the crowd intensified under the Bloodsong's guidance.
The threat lingers. Someone here had a hand in this.
The sound of falling masonry made him turn back to the shop. The walls were crumbling as the fire ate the timbers inside. With the walls gone, the many statues inside were revealed. Gods, heroes, and emperors serene and unmoving amidst the flames. The murmur of the crowd fell to hushed reverence, a few voices uttering prayers and supplications.
It's not there, Velen realized,
sweat beating on his brow as he moved closer to scan the blaze. The wolf is gone.
In the morning, he searched amidst the wreckage, sifting ash under the impassive gaze of the blackened but otherwise undamaged marble gods. It had taken hours for the fire to subside, despite the countless water buckets heaved at it by the townsfolk and gathered soldiery. Eventually, when it became clear the surrounding houses were in no danger, he called a halt and let it burn. As dawn lit the city, he sought out the block with its vital secret. Finding nothing but ash and a few scattered pieces of marble that might have been anything. The blood song was a constant mournful throb at the base of his skull.
Nothing, he thought. This has all been for nothing.
You look tired.
Sharon stood nearby, grey-cloaked and pale in the lingering smoke rising from the charred ruin. Her face was still guarded, but he saw no anger there, just fatigue.
As do you, sister.
The curative worked. The girl will be fully recovered in a few days. I thought I should let you know.
Thank you.
She gave a barely perceptible nod.
It's not quite over yet. We need to keep watch for more cases, but I'm confident any outbreak can be contained. Another week and the city can be opened once more.
Her eyes surveyed the ruins, then seemed to notice the statues for the first time. Her gaze lingering on the massive form of the man and the lion locked in combat.
Marchul, god of courage, he told her, battling the nameless great lion that laid waste to the southern plains.
She reached up to caress the god's unfeasibly muscled forearm.
Beautiful.
Yes, it is.
I know you're tired, sister, but I would be grateful if you could look at the man who carved it. He was badly burned in the fire.
Of course. Where do I find him?
At the guild house, near the docks. I've had quarters prepared for you there. I'll show you.
I'm sure I can find it. She turned to go, then paused.
Governor Arawan told me about the night you took the city, how you secured his cooperation. I feel my words may have been overly harsh.
She held his gaze, and he felt the familiar ache in his chest. But this time it warmed him, dispelling the Bloodsong's sorrowful dirge and bringing a smile to his lips, though the departed knew he had little to smile about.
"You have been released on the king's orders," he said. "Brother Frentis brought a royal command."
"Really?"
She arched an eyebrow.
"May I see it?"
"Sadly, it has been lost."
He gestured at the smoking mess around them by way of explanation.
"Unusually clumsy of you, Balin."
"No, I'm often clumsy, in my deeds and my words."
A brief answering smile lit Sharon's face before she looked away. "I should see to this artistic friend of yours."
The gates were opened 7 days later. Velen also ordered the sailors released, though only one crew at a time. It provoked little surprise when most chose to leave port with the earliest tide, the Red Falcon amongst the first to depart. Captain Nurin hounding his crew with desperate urgency, as if afraid Velen would attempt a last-minute retrieval of the Bluestone. Some of the richer citizens also chose to leave. Fear of the Red Hand did not fade quickly. Velen managed to intercept the one-time employer of the man who had set fire to Armlin's shop, a richly attired if somewhat bedraggled spice merchant, chafing under guard at the eastern gate as Velen questioned him. His family and remaining servants lingered nearby, pack horses laden with assorted valuables.
His name was Carpenter, as far as I knew, the merchant said. I can't be expected to remember every servant in my employ. I pay people to remember for me.
The man's knowledge of the realm tongue was impeccable, but there was an arrogant disdain to his tone Valin didn't like. However, the fellow's evident fear made him suppress the urge to deliver an encouraging cuff across the face.
"He had a wife?" he asked. "A family?"
The merchant shrugged.
"I think not. Seemed to spend most of his free time carving wooden effigies of the gods. I heard he was injured. A blow to the head."
"Most of us were that night." The merchant lifted a silken sleeve to display a stitched cut on his forearm.
"Your men were very free with their clubs."
"The carpenter's injury," Valin pressed.
"He took a blow to the head. A bad one, it seems. My men carried him back to the house unconscious. In truth, we thought him dead, but he lingered for several days, barely breathing. Then he simply woke up, showing no ill effects. My servants thought it the work of the gods, a reward for all his carvings. The next morning he was gone, having said no words since his awakening."
The merchant glanced back at his waiting family, impatience and fear showing in the tremble of his hands.
"I know you are not complicit in this," he told the merchant, stepping aside. "Luck to you on your journey."
The man was already moving away, shouting commands to put his household on the road.
"He lingered for days," Valin mused, and the blood song stirred, sounding a clear note of recognition.
He felt the familiar sense of fumbling for something, some answer to the many mysteries of his life, but once again it was beyond his reach. Frustration seized him, and the blood song wavered.
"The song is you," Armlin had said. "You can sing it as well as hear it."
He sought to calm his feelings, trying to hear the song more clearly, trying to focus it.
"The song is me, my blood, my need, my hunt."
It swelled within him, roaring in his ears, a cacophony of emotion, blurred visions flicking through his mind too fast to catch. Words spoken and unspoken rose in an incomprehensible babble, lies and truth mingling in a maelstrom of confusion. "I need Armlin's counsel," he thought, trying to focus the song, forcing harmony into the discordant din. The song swelled once more, then calmed to a single clear note, and there was a brief glimpse of the marble block, the chisel resuming its impossibly rapid work. Guided by an unseen hand, the face emerging, features forming. Then it was gone. The block blackened and shattered amidst the wasted ruin of the mason's home. Valin moved to a nearby step and sat down heavily. It appeared there had been but one chance to know what message the block contained. This verse was over, and he needed a new tune. Chapter 8. He was called to the gate at midnight, General Norrin limping to his room in the guild house to wake him.
"Scores of horsemen on the plain, my lord," the minstrel said. "Brother Canis requested your presence."
He quickly strapped on his sword and mounted spit, galloping to the gatehouse in a few minutes. Canis was already there, ordering more archers onto the walls. They climbed the stairs to the upper battlements, where one of Count Marvin's Nilsalins pointed to the plain.
"Near 500 of the buggers, my lord," the man said, voice shrill with alarm.
Valin calmed him with a pat to the shoulder and moved to the battlement, looking down on a small host of armored riders, steel gleaming a faint blue in the dim light from the crescent moon. At their head, a burly figure in rust-stained armor glared up at them.
"You ever going to open this bloody gate?"
Baron Banders demanded.
"My men are hungry and I've got blisters on my arse."
Shorn of his armor, the Baron was smaller in stature but no less bullish.
"Pah!"
He spat a mouthful of wine onto the floor of the guildhouse chamber, which served as their meal hall.
"Alpiran piss! Don't you have any cumbrailing to offer an honored guest, my lord?"
"I regret my brothers and I are guilty of exhausting our reserves, Baron," Valin replied. "My apologies.
Banders shrugged and reached for the roasted chicken on the table, tearing off a leg and chomping into the flesh.
"I see you managed to leave most of this place standing,"
he commented around a mouthful.
"Locals couldn't have put up much of a fight.
We were able to effect a stealthy seizure of the city. The governor has proved a pragmatic man. There was little bloodshed." The baron's face became somber, and he paused for a moment before washing down his food and reaching for more.
"Couldn't say the same about Marbellus. Thought the place was going to burn forever."
Venner's disquiet deepened. The baron's unexpected appearance was unsettling, and it seemed he had dark news to impart.
"The siege was difficult?"
Banders snorted, pouring himself more wine.
4 weeks of pounding with the engines before we had a practical breach. Every night they'd sally out, small parties of dagger men, sneaking through our lines to cut throats and hold the water barrels. Every bloody night a sleepless trial. The departed know how many men we lost. Then the battle lord sent 3 full regiments into the breach. Maybe 50 men made it out again, all wounded. The Arpirans had set traps in the breach, spiked pits and so forth. When the realm guard got held up by the pits, they sent bundles of kindling rolling in, all soaked in oil. Their archers set them blazing with fire arrows.
He paused, eyes closed. A small shudder ran through him.
You could hear the screams a mile away.
The city's not taken?
Oh, it's taken. Taken and taken again like a cheap whore.
Banders belched.
Bloodrose licked his wounds and drew his plan well. In truth, I think his assault on the breach was a grand ruse. A sacrifice to convince the Alpirans they were facing a fool. 2 nights later, he drew up 4 regiments opposite the breach, making ready to assault. At the same time, he sent the entire remaining Realm Guard infantry against the eastern wall with scaling ladders. He gambled the Alpirans were concentrating their strength at the breach and didn't leave enough men to defend the walls. Turns out he was right. Took all night, and the cost was high, but by morning, the city was ours. What was left of it?
Banders lapsed into silence, concentrating on his meal.
Ben let him eat, and found his gaze lingering on the baron's perennially rust-stained armor. On seeing it up close for the first time, he noticed that those parts of steel plate not besmirched with corrosion gleamed with a polished sheen, and the rust itself had an odd, waxy texture.
"It's paint," he said aloud.
"Hmm?"
Banders glanced over at his armor and grunted.
"Oh, that. A man should try to live up to his legend, don't you think?"
"The legend of the Rusty Knight?" Velen asked.
"Can't say I've heard it, my lord."
"Aha!
But you're not Renfalin," Banders grinned. "My father was a boisterous, kind-hearted fellow, but overfond of dice and harlots, and consequently unable to leave me much more than a crumbling holdfast and a rusty suit of armor, which I was obliged to wear when answering the lord's call to war. Luckily, my father had managed to pass on something of his skill with the lance, and so my standing grew with every battle and tourney. I was famed as the Rust Knight, loved by the commons for my poverty. The armor became my banner, made me easy to find in the melee, something for the peasants to cheer and my men to rally to, once I had fortune enough to hire some, of course.
So this is not the original armor?"
Banders laughed heartily. "Faith, no, brother. That's all rusted to uselessness years ago. Even the best armor rarely lasts more than a few years in any case. Battle and the elements take their toll. We have a saying in Renfell, if you want to be richer than a lord, become a blacksmith."
He chuckled and poured himself more wine.
"Why are you here, Baron?" Benin asked him.
"Do you bring word from the battle lord?"
The Baron's expression sobered once again.
"I do. I also bring myself and my men. 300 knights and 200 armed retainers, and assorted squires, if you'll have us. You and your men are most welcome, but will Fief Lord Theros not have need of your services?"
Banders set aside his wine and sighed heavily, meeting Velen's eyes with a level gaze.
I have been dismissed from the Fief Lord's service, brother. Not for the first time, but I suspect the last. The Battle Lord bid me offer my command to you. You quarrelled with the Fief Lord?
Not with him, no.
His mouth was set in a hard, unyielding line, and Velin sensed it was best to let the matter drop.
And the Battle Lord's word?
Banners pulled a sealed letter from his shirt and tossed it on the table.
I know the contents to save you reading it.
You're instructed to make the city safe against imminent siege. Border patrols from Arbelis spied a great host of Alperians making its way north. They appear intent on bypassing Arbelis and seizing Linesh with all dispatch.
He took another deep gulp of wine, wiping his mouth and belching again.
My advice, brother, commandeer the merchant fleet and sail your men back to the realm. There isn't a hope of holding this place against so many.
At least 10 cohorts of infantry, another 5 of horse, and assorted savages from the southern provinces of the Empire. Nearly 20,000 in all.
Vander's voice was light, but all present could sense the weight behind his levity.
Velen had called a council of captains in the guildhouse, having had Canis search the city archive for the largest and most accurate map of the northern Alperian coast.
I thought there would be more, Canis said. The Emperor's army is supposed to be beyond counting.
Indeed there are more, brother, Banders assured him. This is just the vanguard. The few prisoners we took in Marbellus were happy to confirm it. The force marching on this city is the elite of the Alperian army, the finest infantry and cavalry he can muster, all veterans of the border wars with the Valerians. Don't underestimate the savages either, all warriors born. It's said they spend their lives worshipping the Emperor like a god, and fighting each other over petty insults, which they're happy to put aside when he calls them to war. Seems they like the taste of defeated enemies.
Siege engine? Velen asked.
Banners nodded. 10 of them, much taller and heftier than anything we have, can sling a boulder the size of a muskox over 300 paces.
Velen glanced around the table, gauging the reaction of the other captains to the Baron's words.
Count Marvin was rigidly controlled, seemingly wary of betraying any emotion that might undermine his jealously guarded status.
Lord Marshal Alcordlin had paled visibly and kept clutching his recently healed arm, a faint sheen of sweat beginning to show on his upper lip. Lord Marshal Altrendel seemed lost in thought, stroking his chin, eyes distant. Velen assumed he was calculating if he could escape with all the spoils he had looted at Untesh. Only Bren Antesh seemed unaffected, arms folded, and regarding Banders with only a mild interest.
"How long do we have?" Kenis asked the Baron.
"Brother Solis put them here."
Banders tapped a finger to the map, spread out on the table before them, picking out a point about 20 miles southwest of Marbellus.
That was 12 days ago. "An army that size couldn't cover more than 15 miles a day,"
Count Marvin mused in a deliberately measured tone.
"Less in the desert." "Gives us maybe another 2 weeks," Lord Marshal Alcordlin said.
His voice was pitched slightly high, and he coughed before continuing.
"Ample time, my lord."
Velen frowned at him.
"Ample time for what?"
"Why, evacuation, of course."
Alcordlin's eyes cast around the table, seeking support.
"I know there aren't sufficient ships remaining to carry the whole of the army, but the senior officers could be got away easily.
The men can march to Untesh."
"We are ordered to hold this city," Velen told him.
"Against 20,000?
Alcordlin gave a short and somewhat hysterical laugh.
"More than 3 times our number, and elite troops at that. It would be madness to—"
"Lord Marshal Alcordlin, I hereby relieve you of your command."
Velen nodded at the door. "Leave this room. In the morning you will be escorted to the harbour, where you will take ship for the realm. Until then, keep to your quarters. I don't want the men infected with your cowardice."
Alcordlin rocked back on his heels as if struck, beginning to babble.
"This is— such insults are unwarranted. My regiment was given to me by the king. Just get out."
The stricken lord cast one more final glance at the rest of the captains, finding either indifference or wary discomfort, before moving to the door and making his exit.
Any more suggestions of evacuation will receive the same response, Velen told the council. I trust that's understood.
He turned his attention back to the map, ignoring the chorus of affirmation. Once again he was struck by the barrenness of the region, marveling that three large cities such as Untesh, Linesh, and Marbellis could exist on the fringes of such trackless desert.
All dust and scrub, as Frentis had said. Haven't seen a tree since we landed.
No trees.
My lord? Baron Banders asked.
Velen gave no reply, and kept his attention on the map as something stirred. The seed of a stratagem, nurtured by a faint murmur from the Bloodsong, building to a chorus as his eyes picked out a pictogram about 30 miles south of the city, a copse of palm trees surrounding a small pool.
What's this? He asked Canis.
The Lelun Oasis, brother. The only sizable source of water on the southern caravan route.
Meaning?
Count Marvin said. The Alperan army will have to stop there on the way north.
You mean to poison the water, my lord?
Lord Marshal Altrendel asked.
An excellent notion. We could spoil it with animal carcasses.
I don't mean to do any such thing, Velen replied, continuing to let the Bloodsong feed his design. The risks are great, and the cost...
We should seal the city, my lord,
Count Marvin said, breaking the silence, which Velen realized had lasted several minutes. The southbound caravans will surely pass word of our numbers to the enemy.
People have been leaving by the dozen since the threat of the Red Hand faded, Velen said.
I'd be greatly surprised if the Alperan commander doesn't already possess a full picture of our numbers and our preparations.
Besides, letting him think us weak could work to our advantage. An overconfident enemy is prone to carelessness.
He gave the map a final glance and moved back from the table.
Baron Banders, I apologize for asking you to take to the saddle again so soon after your arrival, but I require you and your knights on the morrow.
He turned to Canis.
Brother, have the scout troop assemble at dawn. I will take command personally. In my absence, the city is yours. Make every effort to deepen the ditch around the walls and double its width. You intend to ambush an army of 20,000 with a few hundred men?
Count Marvin was incredulous.
What can you hope to achieve?
Velen was already moving to the door.
An axe without a blade is just a stick.
Further inland, the northern desert sands rose into tall dunes, stretching to the horizon like a storm-swept sea, frozen in gold under a cloudless sky. The sun was too intense to permit marching during the day, and they were obliged to travel by night, sheltering under tents in daylight, whilst the knights grumbled, and their war horses nickered and stamped hooves in irritation at the unaccustomed heat.
Noisy buggers, this lot, Dentos observed on the second day out.
Velen glanced over at a clutch of knights, bickering and shoving each other over a game of dice. Nearby, another knight was loudly berating his squire for the lack of polish on his breastplate. He had to agree that the knights were hardly the most stealthy soldiers, and he would have gladly exchanged them all for a single company from the order. But there were no brothers to be had, and he needed cavalry for this to work.
It shouldn't matter, he replied. They only have to make one charge.
Though I couldn't say how many will be left after that.
What about patrols? Frentis asked. The Alperans will be fools not to scout their flanks.
This far out from the city, I'm hoping they're foolish enough to do just that. If not, we'll only have to linger for one day in any case. Any patrol that finds us will have to be silenced, and we'll hope they aren't missed by nightfall. It took another 2 nights before the oasis came into view, shimmering into solidity amidst the baking dunes. Velen was surprised by the size of it, expecting little more than a pond and a few palms, but in fact finding a small lake surrounded by lush vegetation, a near irresistible jewel of green and blue.
No sign of the Alperans, brother, Prentice said, reining in with the scout troop at the foot of the dune, where he had halted to survey the oasis.
Seems we beat them to it, like you said.
Caravans?
Velen asked him.
Nothing for miles around.
We saw scant sign of traders on our journey north, my lord, Baron Banders commented.
War is never good for commerce. Unless you're trading in steel, of course.
Velen surveyed the desert,
spying a tall, almost mountainous dune 2 miles to the west.
"There," he said, pointing. "We'll camp on the westward slope, no fires, and it would be greatly appreciated, Baron, if your men refrained from excessive noise."
"I'll do what I can, my lord, but they're not peasants, you know. Can't just flog them like your lot."
"Maybe you should, my lord," Dentos suggested. "Remind them they bleed the same color as us peasants."
"They'll bleed well enough when the Alpirans come, brother,"
Bander snapped back, his already flushed face coloring further.
"Enough!" Verin cut in.
"Brother Dentos, go with Brother Frentis. Fetch as much water as you can carry. Leave as little sign as possible. I don't want our foes to think anything bigger than a spice caravan has passed here in weeks."
It was 2 more days before the Emperor's army appeared, heralded by a tall column of dust rising above the southern horizon. Velin, Frentis, and Dentos lay atop a high dune to observe their advance to the oasis. The cavalry appeared first, small parties of outriders, followed by long columns riding two abreast. Velin counted 4 regiments of lancers, plus an equal number of horse-borne archers. Their discipline and efficiency was impressive, evident in the speed with which they established their camp, tents and cooking fires appearing amidst the palms of the oasis within an hour of their arrival. He borrowed the spyglass from Frentis, and picked out officers and sergeants amongst the throng, marking their stern visage and easy authority as they posted pickets in a tight and well-placed perimeter. Veterans indeed, he decided, regretting he hadn't had time to say his goodbyes to Sharon before they left. Although he had sensed a softening in her regard at their last meeting, he still had much to explain. He tracked the spyglass away from the oasis and focused on a second dust cloud arising to the south, the wavering stick figures of the Alpirian infantry materializing out of the desert heat with unwelcome clarity. It took over an hour for the infantry to file into the oasis and make camp. Master Solis's estimate had been conservative. There were in fact 12 cohorts of infantry, swelling the Alpirian force to at least 30,000, and making Velin consider for only the briefest second if Lord Marshal Alcordlin hadn't been right after all.
"See there?" Frentis pointed, lifting his eye from the spyglass.
"Battle Lord, maybe."
Velin took the glass and followed his finger to a large tent, pitched to the north of the oasis. A group of soldiers were erecting a tall standard bearing a red banner, adorned with an emblem of 2 crossed sabers in black. They were overseen by a tall man in a gold cloak, with hard ebony features and grey peppered hair. Nelison Nestor Heverin, captain of the 10th cohort of the Imperial Guard, come to keep a promise. He watched the captain turn and bow to a stocky man with a pronounced limp. He wore old but serviceable armor and a cavalry saber at his belt. His skin had the olive hue of the northern provinces, and his head was shaven bald. He listened to Heverin for a few moments, as the captain appeared to make some kind of report, then cut him off with a dismissive wave of his hand, stomping off to the tent without sparing him another glance.
"No, the limping man is the battle lord," Velin said.
He noted the weary slump of Heverin's shoulders before it straightened and marched away.
"Shamed," he decided.
"Shunned because you lost the hope.
What were you suggesting, I wonder? More patrols, more guards? More regard for the cunning of the hope killer?
Wouldn't listen, would he?"
For the first time since leaving the city, Velin felt his mood begin to lighten. It was early evening by the time the siege engines came into view. He had been nurturing the faint hope that Bandus had exaggerated Solis's report with the telling, but he knew now the Baron had spoken true. The Realm Guard had engines of its own, mangonels and catapults for slinging boulders and fireballs at or over castle walls. But even the largest and most carefully crafted could not compare with the obvious power of the devices the Emperor had sent to bring down the walls of Linesh. Lumbering giants in the gathering gloom, their weighted arms swayed as great teams of oxen drew them onwards. The engines were escorted by perhaps 3,000 men. From their loose formation and non-uniform appearance, clearly the tribesmen Bandus had described. Their costumes varied in color from garish red silk and blue feathered headdresses to sober black or blue robes devoid of decoration. Their weaponry and armor was equally diverse.
He picked out a few breastplates and mail shirts, but most seemed unarmored, save for round wooden shields decorated with unfathomable sigils. Weapons seemed to consist mainly of long spears, with serrated iron blades, augmented with viciously spiked clubs, and maces worn at the belt, along with daggers and short swords. Velin watched as the oxen hauled the engines to the southern edge of the oasis, the drovers unlimbering the teams to lead them to the water, and the tribesmen making their camp around the tall frames. "That's a lot of savages to cut through, brother," Dentos commented. "If it works, we won't have to." Velin handed the spyglass back to Frentis. "Let's pack the horses. We'll move out with the moonrise." Spit, to Velin's complete lack of surprise, proved unsuited to the role of pack horse. The stallion's ill temper taking a dangerous turn as he attempted to hoist the pack onto his back, his hooves stamping with perilous disregard for toes and feet. It took several precious minutes of cajoling, threatening and bribing with sugar lamps, before he was sufficiently settled to allow the pack to be secured in place, by which time the bright crescent of the moon was high overhead. "Why you hold on to that beast is a mystery, brother," Dentos observed, his voice slightly muffled by the muslin scarf covering the lower half of his face. "He's a fighter," Velin replied. "It makes up for the bruises." He scanned the assembled scout troop, each man similarly garbed in white muslin robes, typical of the traders who tracked spice and other valuables across the desert to the northern ports. Every mount was laden with packs, each bulging with the round red clay pots used for carriage of spices, although tonight they were filled with a different cargo. He knew they were unlikely to fool an experienced eye, their mounts too tall and their garb showing too many unfamiliar details, not to mention the odd bulge of a concealed weapon. But for a few vital moments, they should be convincing enough in the dark. He hoped it would be enough. He glanced to the north, marking the winding trail of the caravan route through the dunes to the oasis. The desert was a strange sight under the moon, the sand painted silver by the light. Taken with the chill of the nighttime desert, it was almost like looking upon a snowfield, once more calling forth the half-forgotten dream, Nursa Silnin's cruel mockery, a body cooling in the snow. "Brother," Frentis asked, breaking the reverie. Velin shook his head to clear the vision, turning to the scout troop and raising his voice. "You all know the importance of our mission tonight. Once it's done, ride for Linesh and don't look back. They'll be on our heels like starved wolves, so don't tarry. Not for anything." He turned back to the north and tugged on Spit's reins. "Come on, you bloody nag." They lit torches and approached at a steady pace, calling greetings in memorized Alpirin to the tribesmen guarding the southern perimeter. They were all tall, lean men, with pointed beards and skin like polished mahogany, their garb a mixture of red-dyed cloth and loose armor fashioned from ivory. Each carried one of the long spears with a serrated blade Velin had noted when they surveyed the camp earlier. They were clearly suspicious, but not overly alarmed, and Velin was relieved when no tumult erupted at the appearance of a small but unknown party. Five of them gathered to obstruct their path as they approached the camp. Spears leveled, but their manner not overly threatening. "Ni-rel-an," Dentos greeted the tribesman. Next to Canis, he had the best ear for Alpirin, although he could hardly be said to be fluent. Despite having been extensively coached by Canis in the few hours before their departure from Linesh, he was unlikely to fool a native of the Northern Empire. It was their fortune that the tribesmen hailed from the southern provinces, and probably knew less of the local dialect than they did. One of the tribesmen shook his head in confusion, saying something in his own language to his fellows, who replied with shrugs of bafflement. "Unterra." Dentos gave the word for trader, patting his chest, then gestured broadly at their makeshift caravan.
"Onterish." "Spice."
The tribesman who had spoken stepped past Dentos, eyes scanning their company with careful scrutiny. He approached Velin, ignoring the affable nod he offered and giving Spit a long look of examination, his eyes narrowing at the sight of the many scars covering the warhorse's legs and flanks. A shout came from one of the other tribesmen,
and the man confronting Valin stepped back quickly, hands tight on his spear, crouching into a fighting stance. Valin held up his hands in placation, pointing to the west. The tribesman risked a glance over his shoulder, straightening in confusion at the sight of a large number of torches appearing out of the desert, about 300 teardrops of light flickering in the gloom, accompanied by the growing telltale rumble of a cavalry charge in full tilt and the peal of multiple trumpets. The tribesman turned to his fellows, mouth opening to voice a command, and died as Valin's throwing knife sank into the base of his skull. The snap of bowstrings and the whistle of thrown blades filled the air as the scout troop freed their weapons to dispatch the remaining sentries.
"Douse the torches! Get to the engines!" Valin barked, tugging spit into a run.
The cacophony of battle erupted as they entered the camp. The thunderclap crash of Baron Banda's knights striking the hastily formed line of defending tribesmen, soon replaced by the familiar din of shrieking horses and clashing metal. Everywhere, tribesmen were gathering weapons and rushing to join the battle, war cries and the harsh, grating peal of their own horns calling them forth. By the time Velin's party were among the tents, most had gone to join the fray, and the few who lingered to trouble them were quickly cut down. They found the engines bare of defenders, save for the artisans who tended them, mostly middle-aged men in leather smocks, with few weapons save for carpentry tools. Valin was sorry they didn't have the good sense to run, killing one who swung at him with a mallet and leaving another clutching a partly severed hand.
"Get out of here!"
he commanded the man, sheathing his sword and unhitching the pack of clay pots from Spit's back. The man just looked up at him in dumb shock, before the loss of blood made him collapse limply into the sand. Valin cursed and left him there, opening the pack and heaving the pots at the nearest engine as fast as he could. They broke against the sturdy wooden frames and spilled their clear, viscous liquid over every surface. Valin quickly exhausted the contents of one pack and hauled another to a second engine, already partly doused by Frentis, who grinned wolfishly.
"Gonna make quite a sight, brother." "That it will."
He emptied the second pack and surveyed the progress of the rest of the party, noting with satisfaction the shattered remains of numerous pots on all 10 engines.
"Right, that's enough," he shouted. "Get them lit."
They retreated 20 yards or so, Valin dragging the wounded artisan behind him, unwilling to let him burn. Dentos and Frentis unlimbered their bows, lit fire arrows, and sent them arching towards the engines, the flames catching the lamp oil instantly. And soon 10 great fires were raging in the midst of the camp, flames engulfing the tall engines in a few moments, ropes and bindings disintegrating in the heat, the great arms of the engines tumbling like pine caught in a forest fire. The flames were bright enough to illuminate the battle raging on the western perimeter, where Baron Banders was now rallying his men for the withdrawal, although the battle-maddened tribesmen were in no mood to let them go. Valin saw several knights pulled from their horses and speared to death in quick succession as they vainly sought to extricate themselves from the struggle. Valin mounted Spit and drew his sword.
"Ride for the city!" he called to the scout troop.
"And you, brother?" Frentis asked.
Valin nodded at the battle.
"The Baron needs some help. I'll be along presently. Let me—"
He fixed Frentis with a look that brooked no argument.
"Take your men home, brother."
Frentis bit down on no doubt bitter words and nodded.
"If you're not back in 2 days, then I'm not coming back, and you will look to Brother Canis for command."
Valin spurred Spit into a gallop and hurtled towards the battle, feeling the war horse tense beneath him in anticipation of combat. He skirted the edge of the throng, lashing out to strike down unwary tribesmen, wheeling away as they swarmed at him, galloping on then repeating the process, seeking to divert their fury enough to allow the knights some relief.
"Eruhin Maktar!"
he shouted repeatedly, hoping they knew what it meant.
"I am the Eruhin Maktar! Come and kill me!"
The words were clearly understood by at least some of the tribesmen, judging by the ferocity with which they pursued him, hurling spears and hatchets with sometimes unnerving accuracy. One showed a remarkable turn of speed, sprinting after Valin as he wheeled away from another pass, leaping onto Spit's back with his war club raised, then tumbling to the sand with an arrow speared through his torso.
"I don't think we should linger much longer, brother," Dentos called.
notching and releasing another shaft as he galloped alongside, a tribesman spinning to the ground a short distance away.
"Thought I'd sent you back to the city," Velen called.
"No, you sent Frentis." Dentos loosed another arrow and ducked a spear.
"We really need to go."
Velen glanced at the main throng, seeing a broad figure in red stained armor riding away from the fight, the Baron choosing to be the last to leave. He pointed to the west, and they turned away, spurring their mounts to even greater speed, the still-burning engines casting long shadows over the sands, fading as they were swallowed by the desert. They rode on through the night, keeping a westward course until sunrise, then turning to the north, only dismounting to walk the horses when the heat began to make them stagger. They stripped the mounts of all excess weight, throwing their mail away but keeping their weapons and remaining canteens of water.
"No sign of him," Dentos said,
shielding his eyes as he scanned the southern horizon.
"Not yet, anyway."
"They'll be along," Velen assured him. He held a canteen to Spit's mouth, the animal snatching it between his teeth and tipping the contents down his throat in a few gulps. Velen wasn't sure how much longer the stallion could last in the heat. The desert was a cruel environment for a north-born animal, evidenced by the foam that covered his flanks and the weary blink of his normally bright and suspicious eye. "With any luck, they're following the Baron's trail," Dentos went on. "More of them to follow after all. I think we used up our share of luck last night, don't you?" Velen waited until Spit had finished drinking, then took hold of his reins.
"We keep walking. If we can't ride in this heat, neither can they."
It was early evening when they saw it, small and faint in the distance, but undeniably real.
15 miles, maybe?
Dentos wondered, eyeing the dust cloud.
Closer to 10.
Velen hauled himself into the saddle, wincing at Spit's weary snort of annoyance.
Seems they can ride in the heat after all.
They kept to a canter for most of the night, wary of pushing the horses to collapse, glancing continually to the south, seeing only the desert and the star-rich sky, but knowing their pursuers were gaining with every mile. The northern shore came into sight with the dawn, the desert sands giving way to scrub, and 6 miles to the east, the white walls of Linesh gleaming in the morning light.
"Brother," Dentos said softly.
Velen turned his gaze southwards. The dust cloud was larger now, the riders raising it clearly visible. He leaned forward to pat Spit's neck, whispering in his ear.
"Sorry."
Leaning back, he kicked his heels against the horse's flanks, and they spurred into a gallop. He had expected Spit to have lost much of his speed, but if anything, he seemed to find some kind of relief in the gallop, tossing his head and snorting either in pleasure or anger. His hooves churned the dusty ground, and they quickly outdistanced Dentos and his struggling mount, so much so that Velen was forced to rein in after 4 miles. They had crested a small rise, overlooking the plain before the city walls. The gates were open, and a line of horsemen were making their way inside, sunlight gleaming on their armor.
"Seems the Baron made it back," Velen observed as Dentos reined in.
"Glad someone did."
Dentos upended a canteen and let the water bathe his face. Behind him, Velen could see their pursuers were closing fast, barely a mile behind. He was right. They weren't going to make it.
"Here," he said, making to dismount. "I have a faster horse. It's me they want."
"Don't be fucking stupid, brother," Dentos said wearily.
He unhitched his bow from the saddle and notched an arrow, wheeling his horse around to face the oncoming horseman. Velen knew there was no dissuading him.
"I'm sorry, brother," he said, voice laden with guilt. "This fool's war, I..."
Dentos wasn't listening, looking off to the south, a puzzled frown on his brow.
"Didn't know they had them here. Big booger too, isn't he?"
Velen followed his gaze, and felt the blood song surge in a fiery tumult of recognition, as his eyes picked out the form of a large grey wolf sitting a short distance away. It regarded him with the impassive, green-eyed stare he remembered so well, from that first meeting in the Urlish.
"You can see him?" he asked.
"Course, he's hard to miss."
The blood song was raging now, a piercing cacophony of warning.
"Dentos, ride for the city." "I'm not going anywhere,"
Something's going to happen. Please, just go.
Dentus was going to argue further, but his gaze was drawn by something else. A great dark cloud rising above the southern horizon, ascending from the desert to at least a mile into the sky, swallowing sunlight in its billowing fury as it swept towards the city, dunes disappearing as it gathered them to its hungry breast. An arrow thumped into the ground a few feet away. Velin turned to see their pursuers now barely 50 yards distant. At least 100 men. Preceded by a swarm of arrows launched at the gallop, a desperate attempt to end the chase before the sandstorm bore down.
"Ride!" Velin shouted, taking hold of Dentus's reins and pulling him along as he kicked spit into a gallop, arrows raining down as they descended the rise and rode for the city. The storm hit before they had covered a third of the distance, the sand blasting into faces and eyes like a cloud of vicious needles. Dentos's mount reared in the fury of it, and Velin lost his grip on the reins, horse and rider disappearing in the whirling red mist. He tried to call for him, but instantly choked on the sand, which sought to fill his mouth. He could only do his best to shield his face and cling on as spit ran blindly through the storm. In desperation, he turned to the blood song, trying to calm it, master it enough to guide its music, to sing. At first, there was only the discordant shriek of wrongness and alarm that had erupted at the sight of the wolf. But as he exerted his will, the confusion began to calm, a few clear notes forming amongst the storm raging in his mind.
"Dentos!" he called, seeking to cast the song into the storm like a grapple. "Find him!"
The song changed again, more notes forming, the music becoming more melodious, almost serene, but tinged with something more, a tone so strange as to be vastly unknowable. The realization dawned like a blow. This is not my song. This is not the song of any man. "Who?" he sang. "Who are you?" The other song changed again, all music fading to be replaced by a single impatient growl. "Please," he begged. "My brother." The wolf's growl became a shout in his mind, strong enough to make him reel in the saddle. Spit whinnied, and reared in alarm as he heaved himself upright, feeling blood begin to pour from his nose.
"No!" he screamed back with every fiber of strength he could force into the song. "I do not want your help!"
Instantly the wind dropped, the harsh blast of grit on his face dissipating to a faint breeze. The wind-tossed sands slowly descending, with a sound like 1,000 whispering voices. Through the fading mist, he saw the dark shape of a rider, no more than 10 yards away, Dentos clearly recognizable from the sword on his back. Relief flooded Velin as he trotted over, reaching out to clasp his brother's shoulder.
"Not a good time to linger, brother."
Dentos pitched from the saddle and fell heavily to the ground. His eyes were open, face pale with a familiar pallor, the arrow that had killed him jutting from his chest, the steel barb wet with blood. They told him later how he had sat there, still and frozen, like one of Armlin's creations, appearing out of the ebbing sandstorm, raising shouts from the sentries on the walls and compelling Canis to frantic efforts to reopen the gate. The Alpiran pursuers, scattered by the storm, were quick to recover their wits and close in on the immobile hope-killer. One galloped to within 20 yards, leaning low over the stallion's neck, bow drawn and shaft ready, teeth bared with hate and triumph. Bren Antesh leapt atop the gatehouse battlements, put an arrow clean through the rider's chest, then barked an order at his archers. 1,000 arrows rose from the walls and descended on the Alpirans in a black hail. Near 100 riders cut down by a single volley. Velin had no knowledge of any of it. There was only Dentos, his slack, empty face, and the arrowhead, gleaming metal shining amongst the red gore. Voices called to him from the walls, but he heard nothing. Canis and Barker sprinted through the reopened gate, stumbling to a halt in shock. Velin couldn't hear their grief or their questions. Dentos and the arrow. "Velin." It was the only voice he could have heard. Sharon was at his side, reaching up to clasp his wrist, his knuckles white as they gripped the reins. "Velin, please." He looked down at her, drinking in the sight of her compassion, the familiar ache, dispelling his numbness with a desperate need and hopeless shame. "I am a murderer," he said, forming each word with cold precision. "No, I am a murderer." He gently pulled her hand away and kicked Spit into a walk, guiding him through the gate and into the city. Chapter 9. He stayed in his room for 2 days, slumped fully clothed on his bunk. General knocked and left food outside his door, but he ignored it. Canis, Barkus, and Frentis each came in turn to call through the door, but he barely heard them. He felt no need of sleep, no hunger, no thirst. There was only Dentos and the arrowhead. And the song, the great unknowable song of the wolf, like a deafening echo in his mind. And the truth, of course, the hateful truth. "I am a murderer." He remembered when he had gone to Dentos to ask for his presence on the mission. "You're the best horse archer we have." He had begun, but Dentos was already packing his kit. "Norta was better," he said, stringing his bow. "Norta's dead." Dentos had simply smiled, and for the first time, Velin realized he had never believed his lie about Norta's fate. How much more had he known? What other secrets had he kept? All of his knowledge gone in an instant, stolen by an arrow loosed by a stranger who probably thought he had felled the Hope Killer himself. Velin wondered if the man had died happy, under the hail of Cumbrelian arrows, perhaps expecting a hero's welcome from the gods. It must have been a terrible disappointment. Towards evening of the second day, his attention was finally drawn by a scratching at the door, accompanied by a plaintive whine. He blinked, gazing at the dim room with blurred eyes, fingers scraping the stubble on his chin, smelling his own stink. "I need a bath," he muttered, rising to open the door. Scratch's weight bore him down effortlessly, his harsh tongue scraping over face and chin with desperate affection. "All right, daft dog," he groaned, pushing the slave hound away with some difficulty. "I'm all right." "Really?" Sherrin was standing in the doorway, arms folded, her expression an echo of the severity he remembered from their first meeting. "Because you look terrible." She turned and descended the steps, returning a few minutes later with a cloth and a steaming bowl of water. She closed the door and sat on the bed as he stripped to the waist and washed. Scratch's head in her lap as she rubbed the fur behind his ears. He could feel her gaze on his torso, knowing her eyes lingered on his scars, sensing her sorrow. "Nothing I didn't earn, sister," he told her, reaching for his razor. "All of it. And more besides." "So you hate yourself now?" There was an edge of anger to her tone. Clearly her bitterness at his beating of Brother Commander Iltis was taking a while to fade. "The things I've done. This war..." He trailed off, closing his eyes briefly before lathering his face and lifting the razor to his skin. "Here." Sherrin rose and moved to his side, taking the razor from him. "You haven't slept. Your hands are unsteady." She pulled a stool over and made him sit. "Relax. I've done this more times than I can remember." He had to admit many barbers would envy the skill with which she wielded the razor, sliding the blade over his skin with deft precision, her healer's hands gentle and soothing. For a moment, he was lost in the scent and the closeness of her. The grief and self-loathing vanished in this new intimacy. He knew he should tell her to stop, that this was inappropriate, but found himself too intoxicated to care. "There." She moved back, smiling down at him, a finger tracing over his chin.